Now, it's difficult to believe, but next year marks the 25th anniversary of the passing of Rory Gallagher, and a new book's just been published, The Man Behind the Guitar, which honours the man who in many ways remains something of an enigma. And he is an enigma because little of his private life, at least until now, has actually been widely known. But between his band, Taste, and then his own solo material, it's remarkable that so little is known of his private life, considering so many people know about his music. He has sold more than 30 million records around the world, and Donal Fallon is here to tell us all about it. Good afternoon, Donal.
Good to be here.
How are you? Listeners might be surprised by just how young Rory Gallagher actually was at the time of his passing.
I was. This is a really remarkable biography. You know, and a good biography will tell you something you know and a lot you don't know.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what this book manages to do. And there is something romantic about the story of Rory Gallagher and something tragic too. He's 47 years of age at the time of his passing.
Mm.
But his legacy is stunning in terms of commercial success and in terms of cultural impact. You know, anyone who can pick up a guitar from Jimi Hendrix to Johnny Marr, you know, has paid tribute to Rory Gallagher.
Mm.
And, you know, it's likely that next year we'll see kind of renewed interest in the musician and his story, being the 25th anniversary of his passing. So this book does exactly what it says on the tin, you know, the man behind the guitar. It's a look at Rory Gallagher as a person, a sometimes tragic story, and a decline, really, of a remarkable mind and remarkable ability.
Yeah, it's quite the arc, given that he only was around for 47 years before his passing. He is someone who, aside from being a bit of an enigma, can't really be pinned down, because both Donegal and Cork lay claim to him.
There are listeners on either end of the country at this moment in time saying Rory Gallagher was one of us.
He's one of ours.
And I think the broad appeal of Gallagher kind of is tied into the fact that he's so deeply connected with different parts of the island of Ireland. So, born in Ballyshannon, raised in Cork, but performed some of his most remarkable gigs in Belfast in particular, and also Dublin. So, deep connections to so many parts of the island of Ireland.
Yeah, there are probably a lot of people who actually think that he was from Northern Ireland, from the six counties, because of the affinity that he held in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the few acts who would play there during the Troubles. I mean, he got a brilliant statue in Ballyshannon in Donegal that captures him in full flow. There's a replica of his Fender guitar on a wall in Temple Bar.
Yep.
Look up, listeners, if you haven't seen it. It's by Meeting House Square. Plaque on the Ulster Hall in Belfast because of that very brave decision to perform there during the Troubles. But I mean, a street in Paris, which is an incredible honour.
Yeah, really.
A plaque in Hamburg on the very same venue where the Beatles performed. I mean, this is a story that spans the entire continent.
Tell us about his background then. He came from a deeply musical family.
Unsurprisingly, music is in the blood. I mean, he's born in 1948. His dad was in a Cayley band, which was the music of the day.
Mm-hmm.
His mother was a brilliant singer and an actor with the Abbey. So you couldn't be anything but a performer in that kind of household. The formative years, Donegal, Derry, and then Cork, McCurtain Street in Cork. And by the age of 9, which is incredible, he's playing the guitar.
And his own, obviously the musical stock is one thing, but his own entry into music is another, and it began, as it often did back in that vintage, with show bands.
Yeah, I love his story. The way he talks about learning how to play music is so innocent. He says, you know, in his own words, "I went to the library once and got the book, Teach Yourself How to Read Music, and it said, sit down at your piano. We didn't have a piano, so that went down the chute. I worked out F, A and C, and you know, that is how I learned to play music. You know, next, I was playing blues and rock and roll, which is fairly instinctive and primitive stuff.
Mm.
Anyways, I mean, to describe the music that he played in his own words as instinctive and primitive stuff is remarkable. But as a youngster, you know, he's influenced by a real diversity of mostly American sounds. Woody Guthrie, Eddie Cochran, Lonnie Donegan, all classics.
Yeah.
But like a lot of young Irish people, his introduction to performing is in the show band scene. And in a sense, the show bands are the best thing and the worst thing that ever happened to Irish music. Because if you're a young musician in a show band, basically what you had to do was play someone else's music, which isn't, you know, all that exciting.
Mm.
You're expected to get up there, give them the hits the way they want them, and send them home sweating. But for a lot of young musicians, it was a chance. That's the name of the great
oral. It should just be known, by the way. It's just literally sweating. That isn't some sort of double entendre, that you're not supposed to take it at any more than face value.
It's a brilliant history of the show band scene. What a name for a book, Send Them Home Sweating. But for a lot of kind of young musicians, including members of Tin Lizzy, the show band scene is where you learned how to hold an instrument. So you weren't playing the music that you wanted to play, but you were making the connections, you were meeting people. And Gallagher, with the band Fontana, really found his feet in the show band scene.
Yeah, and of course it does help people then to develop a culture of knowing what it's like to perform on stage and to sort of develop that sort of affinity and to figure out
and to get paid
of course. But that was all, you know. And by the way, we shouldn't knock people who can only play three chords, because there's plenty of musicians who's made millions out of only been able to play three chords.
Yeah.
So the F, A and the C will do more than enough for him on that.
Three chords and the truth, as the Ramones put it.
There you go. But the particular instrument for which he's obviously most known, as you mentioned, there's a Fender replica up on the wall in Meeting House Square. It is obviously the guitar, and yet he stumbled on the guitar completely by accident, really.
There's a couple of people that are just synonymous with their instrument. For me, you know, Seamus Ennis, and we talked about him on the slot earlier in the year, and that set of pipes, and Rory Gallagher, and that particular Fender guitar in the window of a music shop in McCurtain Street in Cork for £100. That's a very princely sum of money, you know, in the 1960s. But it's in the window secondhand, even though it's basically brand new. And the legend is that another musician entirely from a show band in Cork had ordered it in, looked at it, said, "That's not the colour I asked for. I'm not taking that," and left it with the shop. So they're trying to get rid of this thing. And for £100, it comes into the hands of young Rory Gallagher. And really, it's synonymous with him. Once it goes into those hands, it never leaves. And later on, he reflected on it. He talked about it like an old friend. You know, he says, "It's dated November 61. In certain people's opinion, that is when Fender hit their peak. I love the maple neck. Like on their earlier guitars, they're probably a bit more crisp, but there's a warmth to it, a mellowness because of the rosewood neck. It's the best. It's my life. It's my best friend. It's almost like knowing the weak spots or strong spots. And I don't like to get sentimental about these things, but when you spend 30 years of your life with the same instrument, it's like a walking memory bank of your life there in your arms." Beautiful, beautiful way with words.
It's a lovely bit of poetry. And actually, it's remarkable to think that so many other musicians, they become associated with brands, but it's never specifically with one instrument itself. That you can talk about different guitarists or drummers or whatever, and they're always known for playing a certain brand, but that it's never just the one guitar.
The literal one guitar, and it's a perfect reproduction of it on the wall in Temple Bar, unveiled by none other than The Edge. And The Edge said great words when he unveiled it. He said, you know, "Rory paved the path that we walked down." So you have this brilliantly talented musician with this incredible guitar, but eventually he manages to break free of the show band scene and he moves his band Fontana into a kind of rhythm and blues kind of sound. And from there came Taste. Absolutely incredible band, extraordinary. I mean, if someone from the show band scene by 1970 is playing the Isle of Wight Festival with Taste,
which must have been a career highlight for him because of how mad it was. And it is, it goes down, it's often overlooked because of the stories you hear down the years of Glastonbury and Woodstock and Lollapalooza and all these things, but like the Isle of Wight was mad.
Leonard Cohen's gig has been released on DVD in recent years. Leonard Cohen is off his face, high as a kite, and that's fine because the crowd are likewise, you know. And how many people are at the Isle of Wight Festival 1970 is disputed. The Guinness Book of Records claims there was anything between 600,000 and 700,000 people.
How can there be that many people?
People gave
like,
out that
health and safety, lads. Come on.
People said it's too many people at Electric Picnic these days. Imagine 700,000 people. It puts Electric Picnic
imagine
in
them
the halfpenny place.
Trying to get buses out of Stradbally when it's all over. You'd be a wild
Oh, God, imagine. And for reasons I can't understand, the organisers felt they couldn't turn a profit on it. Now, if you can't turn a profit on a festival,
it's 700,000 people.
Something's gone wrong. So they essentially did it for free. It became this great free festival.
Okay.
And young people swarmed the Isle of Wight from near and far. And for anyone who was there, Taste were one of the highlights. I mean, you had The Who, you had Jimi Hendrix, Leonard Cohen, and Taste. Incredible.
It's some company to keep. We touched upon it just there a few minutes ago. His willingness to play in Belfast during the Troubles, which is a time when not many other people would venture to go to a deeply troubled city, won him an awful lot of admiration.
And to be young in Belfast in the 1970s was difficult. And a lot of people up there felt that their youth was kind of taken from them. There was an unwillingness of bands to travel and to play there. So The Clash, great punk band The Clash, arrive in Belfast 1977. They have a look at it and say, no way, we're not doing this. And they photograph themselves kind of standing around British Army trucks looking hard, but they never played a gig. It wasn't very punk rock, to be honest.
It's very ironic of a band also called The Clash. There was any kind of a dissent in society, they were like, this isn't
No, we can't do this. We can't do this. So Joe Strummer and The Clash didn't do the gig. Rory, by comparison, plays Belfast through the very worst days. And there's a lovely account of 1972. 1972 would be one of the bloodiest years of the conflict. Mm. New Year's Day 1972, and a Melody Maker journalist who's there remembering it said, "I've never seen anything quite so wonderful, so stirring, so uplifting, so joyous as when Gallagher walked on stage. The whole place erupted. They stood, they cheered, they yelled, they screamed, put their arms up and they embraced. But then as one unit, they put their arms in the air and gave peace signs without being silly or over emotional. It was one of the most remarkable moments and memorable moments of my life. It meant something. It meant more than just rock and roll. Bigger, something more valid than just that." So the ability to bring young people together, you know, Catholic, Protestant and dissenter in the Belfast of 1972 was a remarkable thing to be able to do, and Gallagher could do it.
Yeah, and tragically enough, we all know what happened in Derry only 3 weeks after that. That was New Year's Day in 1972. Mm. Before the end of the month, things had gone pretty sour in the other major city in the north. He did swerve much of celebrity, which is part of the reason why he is that much of an enigma. But unfortunately, he wasn't able to swerve many of the trappings of fame, notably alcohol.
People knew almost nothing of his private life. And there are all kinds of rumours as a result of that. And his biographer notes that, you know, probably because there was never a woman closely associated with him publicly, the suggestion persisted that he might have been gay and either didn't realise it or want to disclose it. There's no evidence to support this. And to be honest, I think it was just music was everything. Mm. And there was no time for anything beyond it. But his vice, unfortunately, was alcohol. And, you know, he found it increasingly difficult to master and to stay in, on top of that. And that would plague him really with ill health in his latter years. I mean, you look at images of him towards the mid-1990s, towards the end of his life. I mean, he's a relatively young man still in his 40s, but the drink had its physical impact on his body and, many people would say, on his abilities.
So he did pass away in the summer of 1995. Tributes were pretty plentiful, but you've picked out one which you believe is particularly moving.
One of our greatest musical journalists in this country, Tony Clayton Lee, just an incredible tribute. Rory Gallagher, whose death by liver failure marked the passing of a more innocent, less mercenary time in Irish rock, was the anti-hero. He sidestepped big time offers and shunned the satin and velvet glamour of the international rock circuit. He was a provincial Irish guy, not at home with urban sophistication, a musician who loved the music for what it was and not for what he could get out of it. Isn't that a magnificent
it's
tribute?
It's remarkable.
Only Tony could put it like that.
You skipped over 10 or 11 important words, actually, which are in brackets in the middle of that, which only goes to show the international esteem in which he was held, that there was a pretty big musical vacancy that he was tapped up
for. I mean, at one stage, when the Rolling Stones, they came looking for him when Mick Taylor was ousted from the band. But another great story concerns Jimi Hendrix, you know, who also played the Isle of Wight. And it's said that when Jimi Hendrix was voted the greatest guitar player in the world by Melody Maker, they asked him how it felt to be the world's greatest guitarist. And Hendrix is said to have replied, "I don't know. Ask Rory Gallagher." And that's a fine tribute.
What a line. The book that Donal has been mentioning, The Man Behind the Guitar, is by Julian Vignoles. It's out now on hardback and you can get it in all good bookshops. Another book that you can get, by the way, in all good bookshops is the Come Here to Me book, volumes 1 and 2.
And your book.
Well, I didn't want to go there, but if you've raised it, End of the Road, 9 Days at the Top of the Taoiseach is available and would be a great Christmas gift alongside The Man Behind the Guitar and the Come Here to Me books, volumes 1 and 2 of which are in all good bookshops now. Donal Fannin, thank you for putting that segue on a plate for me, and thank you for your company.